universe cosmology in place, which is what happens to quantum fields in De Sitter space. So we saw that if we have a massless scalar in De Sitter, then the spectrum of fluctuations, which is just related to the mode functions that we solve for through our famous equation, the v double dot k squared plus m squared a squared minus a double dot over a vk equals zero. So for a massless field, we got this. So the amplitude of fluctuations is just basically proportional to h, or the energy scale of inflation, or in this case, it's just a De Sitter space, so the energy scale of this De Sitter space. And so first we did this in De Sitter. What that means is h is fixed. And then we did the more interesting thing relevant to our universe, which is what happens to a scalar in a background inflationary universe. So that means we take this result here and we promote h to a time-dependent thing, right? So what we found by solving this equation is that once these modes become superhorizon, they stop evolving, they freeze out in amplitude. But the amplitude depends on the value of h at which they froze out, okay? So that means that delta phi was no longer scale invariant. The spectrum is no longer scale invariant. And actually, there were two reasons. So one reason, which holds for a massless field, is that h is decreasing with time because we're rolling down some hill. Okay, so h is decreasing with time. And that means that the small k modes, which crossed the horizon earlier when the field was far up on the hill, get a larger amplitude than those that cross the horizon later when the field is a little bit lower down. Yeah. So that was one source of non-scale invariance. And then if I have a massive field, there was another source of non-scale invariance, which is the fact that the amplitude of massive fields doesn't remain strictly constant on superhorizon scales. It actually decays a little bit with time. And so that has the opposite effect, because these small k modes, the large scale modes, they cross the horizon earlier, so they have longer to decay than the large k modes, right? So that these two are competing effects. One is acting to give you more amplitude on larger scales, and the other is acting to give you less amplitude on larger scales. Yeah, that's right. So h during inflation is 8 pi g over 3 times v. So it's a potential energy dominated universe. And so that means that early on we're up on the hill at high v, and therefore large h. And then a little bit later we're rolling down, so v gets smaller, and thus h gets smaller. So there are these two competing effects, and we calculated the power spectrum. So for the first effect, we just have to take into account the fact that h is changing with time. So when I evaluate this thing, when modes cross the horizon, that is when k equals ah, this can vary. And then we had to correct this by this factor here, which took into account this decay of massive fields. This is basically just the amount by which a mode of a given wave number k would decay, okay, by the end of inflation. So this fits this sort of template here, where I've got an amplitude times k to some power, ns minus 1. And so these two sources of variation with scale, or ns minus 1, we've got a negative 2, this slow roll parameter we called epsilon 1. So remember, epsilon 1 was negative dh dt over h squared. So that's a measure of how quickly the Hubble constant as changing with time. And then we had this thing, which came from the mass, okay, of the scalar field. So we have these two sources of non-scale invariance, and as advertised, we've got this one, negative 2 epsilon 1, which acts to make the amplitude on small k larger. And then we've got this other effect, which has the opposite, right? So for this massive field, it wants to make things blue. So this wants to make things red. This wants to make things blue. Where red means that ns minus 1 greater than 0, less than 0, and blue means that the opposite, right? Okay, so that was the picture we saw yesterday. So one thing that maybe passed by because I was going pretty fast is that this is for a scalar in a background inflationary universe. So you can think of this almost, it's like a test field, right? It's not the inflaton. It's just some field that's living in this background universe. Okay. So this result is strictly valid only for a field in this background. So obviously, we probably want to know what happens to the inflaton itself. Okay, and that's what we're going to do today. So one thing that you'll note was missing from this over here is the fluctuations in the metric. So we had some test field, and basically our assumption was that it made up a negligible fraction of the total energy density, right? So here the assumption was that the field makes no contribution to the overall energy density, right? So I could forget about the metric fluctuations. But now the inflaton is the thing that's driving inflation. So the inflaton is making up all of the energy density, basically, right? And that means that I should worry about the metric. Okay, so you'll recall that when we were studying the late universe, perturbations in the late universe, we had this issue of choosing a gauge. And that's still here, right? So we need to, in order to proceed, we need to pick a gauge to work in, just like we did before. So before, in the late universe, by the way, late universe is totally relative. So if you talk to someone like me, late universe means anything after, 10 to the minus whatever seconds. But for most people, that probably means galaxy formation and stuff. So by late universe, I just mean after inflation. So in the late universe, we had chosen this conformal Newtonian gauge. That was a convenient gauge for us to work in. And so we picked it. And you'll just remember that this looked like this, okay, so that was the metric we chose. That was the gauge we worked in. However, we're going to find it convenient to work in a different gauge. And that's fine. We can always just pick whatever coordinate system we find to be most convenient. And the only piece that we'll need is how to relate this new coordinate system to the one that we used in the late universe, but that's okay, we can do that. Okay. So in the early universe, we're going to find it most convenient to use something called the co-moving gauge. And in fact, you've seen this before. If you recall your cosmology review class, Latham gave you a homework assignment that worked in the co-moving gauge. We're basically going to reproduce what Latham already asked you to do in the first 15 minutes or so. So in the co-moving gauge, the metric looks like this. So we still have some potential psi. Of course, your favorite potential, because it's called psi. And then there's going to be an off-diagonal x time component now. We've got this b. And we're also going to have this function called zeta. So this is just the scalar part, right? And then today in the tutorial, you're going to worry about the tensor part. So there's going to be gravitational waves you need to worry about too. But we'll just do the scalars for today. OK, so you'll notice that there's 1, 2, 3 metric functions, right? And if you recall to the lecture on choosing a gauge in cosmological perturbation theory, I should be able to reduce it just to 2 metric functions, okay? But there's an additional condition that I impose in the co-moving gauge. So I've used one freedom to remove one of these metric functions. But then instead of putting a condition on the metric function, I'm going to put a condition on the energy momentum tensor. Namely, I'm going to require that the off-diagonal components are 0. So for a co-moving observer, they would see no energy flux, right? So they would see no off-diagonal components of the energy momentum tensor. That's kind of by definition. So that's by definition a co-moving observer wouldn't see that. So this, for our perturbed scalar field, if you expand out the energy momentum tensor, is just related to the background solution times derivatives of the field perturbation. So I guess we should make that definition here. We're going to say that phi is going to be some phi naught as a function of eta plus some perturbation that depends on x and eta. And this has been the object of our interest. We've been studying the quantum fluctuations in this guy here, right? Okay, so this is our condition on the energy momentum tensor. And you can see that this basically means that delta phi cannot be a function of x. And so we can just set it to 0. So in this gauge, there are no scalar field fluctuations, right? So you can think, you know, if I had some coordinate system some different coordinate system, say this was the sort of conformal Newtonian one. And in this coordinate system, I had surfaces of constant phi that look like this. At a given constant eta, you can see that I certainly see variations in phi with position. But all I've done is locally taken my time coordinate and shifted it so that now I'm measuring time basically as constant phi. So phi equals constant now turns into my new coordinate, eta, equals constant. So I'm just choosing my time variable so that everywhere I shift to cancel out this variation in delta phi. So this is kind of nice because at least in the early universe, anisotropic stress is negligible. So really, in the early universe, there's just going to be one scalar degree of freedom, and that's going to be zeta. Okay. So the scalar field plus these metric fluctuations, we can just encapsulate almost, well, we can entirely encapsulate in one variable, zeta. And that's why it's kind of nice to use this gauge. Because if I had worked in this Newtonian gauge, I can't do that. Then the real scalar fluctuation, the 1 degree of freedom, would be some combination of one of these Newtonian potentials and then delta phi. So I need to worry about two things. But here, this makes life easy. So it makes life easy for another reason, another advantage of making this choice is that zeta is constant on super horizon scales for, quote, adiabatic perturbations, which equals basically the thing that we've been calling the delta phi equals constant mode. So that's an adiabatic perturbation. So it will hold that the fluctuations we care about will be constant on super horizon scales, just like this delta phi equals constant mode. Okay, and that's a little bit nicer because the inflaton decays at the end of inflation, so I'd have to worry about how that delta phi mode turned into something else, right? But zeta sticks around. That's just a metric perturbation, and that's going to be something that possibly later would turn into galaxies and structure and stuff. So how is zeta related to the thing that we need in the late universe? So we can do that basically by looking at what kind of time shifts are required for us to go between the conformal Newtonian gauge and this gauge where I just have zeta and no delta phi. So at least on super horizon scales, we can make the identification that zeta is equal to negative psi minus 1/3 times delta t 0 over rho plus p. And this is during the inflationary universe, rho plus p is defined by the scalar field. And then in the late universe, this rho plus p is defined by radiation or matter, whatever, right? But this is always the way to go between this co-moving gauge and the conformal Newtonian gauge. And so really the only thing we'll need is that if we evaluate this during radiation domination, then zeta is going to be negative 3/2 psi. That just comes from evaluating this component here. Okay. And if we look at large scales, then you'll recall that we had that phi is negative psi. So zeta is just 3/2 phi on the largest scales. Okay. So now let's sort of regroup, and I want to draw a picture of the story of inflation. So there's a few languages we can use depending on which gauge we're in. So the story of inflation in this co-moving gauge, or the story of a mode, this is co-moving scale and time. So here is the co-moving horizon, 1 over AH. We know that that decreases during inflation, and then it starts to increase after inflation. So this here would be reheating when inflation ends. And then I have some mode here, which has a constant co-moving scale. So this is K equals constant. So here, somehow, we need to sort. Well, so at the late universe, after reheating, we know if there's something out here on super horizon scales. I've just told you that zeta is constant, and that will source a mode phi equals constant when it comes back into the horizon. And then from here on, maybe this is the time when the CMB formed, so this mode has had some chance to oscillate. It made the baryon acoustic oscillations, and then this we turn into the CLs that we see today, right? So that's the story of this mode on super horizon scales. And now I need to figure out some way to make it, right? So inflation is the way to make it. And here, we had seen before that you can get fluctuations in some scalar field. We'll see in a second that this will give you fluctuations in zeta. And then once that becomes super horizon, then perhaps this can source the stuff that we see today. So there's another little piece here that's missing, right? Which is that somehow we're gonna have to make these sort of quantum mechanical fluctuations classical. So somehow we're going to have to turn these quantum fluctuations in the scalar field into sort of classical expectation values, so ensemble averages. This has a long and storied history, and there are still papers that are written and arguments that are had on this. There's kind of a standard set of arguments that I find to be fairly convincing, but not so convincing that I could give you like a really strong, confident argument that yes, this is the precise reason. But there are words like decoherence and this and that thrown around. Suffice it to say, for the purposes of this lecture series, which unfortunately I wish I had you for another week and we could like really think about this and go into the issues, this is a necessary condition, right? So somehow we have to turn these quantum fluctuations classical. And in that case, this whole story will follow. Okay, so I've told you that zeta can eat up this scalar degree of freedom. And the way we can see that, so now let's see how we make quantum fluctuations in zeta. So we can look at the action for gravity coupled to a scalar field. Okay, so the action for gravity coupled to a scalar field would just be x square root minus g. And then we've got the Einstein-Hilbert action. And then the action for a scalar field. Okay, so we have the inflaton and we have gravity. And we've chosen a metric that's going to be this co-moving gauge, right? And so we're going to have in here living some background piece, and then we're going to have some pieces that have to do with fluctuations. So before we get there, let me just say one word on units. Okay. So beware. There are multiple things called the Planck mass that people use that are actually different by a factor of 8 pi. And if you're not careful, you'll screw up by factors of 8 pi. So 1 over 16 pi g, right? So g was related to m Planck. So g is 1 over m Planck squared, okay? But then there's something called the reduced Planck mass, which absorbs, that's not a pi squared, it's just pi, which absorbs the factor of 8 pi into m Planck squared. And then annoyingly, sometimes theorists like to set m Planck equals 1, or sometimes they like to set the reduced Planck mass equal to 1. So you don't really know which one you're talking about. And the answers you get will be different by a factor of 8 pi. Just so you're aware. If you look at different papers and there's some weird factors of 8 pi flying around, it's because they made one of these two choices. Okay, so that's just a little aside. So now what we're going to do is we're going to have R, and that's going to be some zeroth order piece. And then there's going to be fluctuations. And the first fluctuation is going to be quadratic in all of the variables that we have that correspond to things going on in R. So R0 just has to do with the scale factor, while the second order piece has to do with zeta squared, so quadratic things involving zeta. And phi now is just going to be phi naught, right? Because in this co-moving gauge, there's no fluctuation in phi. So everything is in here. So that's kind of nice. I can, when I expand this action out, I'm going to get a zeroth order piece, and phi is only going to contribute to the zeroth order piece, not the quadratic piece. So we'll take our action. That'll be made up of the zeroth order piece, and then we'll get a second order piece. And after a little bit of pain, what you will find is that this second order piece of the action, which just comes from substituting our metric into the Ricci scalar, expanding to quadratic order, and then using the Einstein equations to get rid of these other metric variables, psi and b. So after some painful algebra, which you might have done a little bit of in the homework, I forget, or maybe Latham did a little bit of, I can't remember, but after a little bit of pain, you will find that this second order piece of the action, for the moment, let's just have things in terms of t and not conformal time. So after a little bit of pain, and the pain is a little bit easier in terms of t instead of eta, this is what you'll get. This is what you'll get for the second order piece of the action. There must be a good joke I can come up with that. This is the piece of the action. So you'll notice that it just involves these second order pieces of zeta, right? So as advertised, this is a quadratic contribution. And now we can just make a definition, and we'll turn this action into something that that you all will immediately recognize. So let's take v to be defined as z times m Planck times zeta, where z is just all this business out front. Here, okay, where z can also be written in terms of this slow roll parameter epsilon 1, which had to do with time derivatives of h. Yeah, so we can turn this into time derivatives of h. So with these definitions, and then go to conformal time, you will find, after doing just a tiny little bit of algebra, that we get an action that looks like this. Which is great, because that looks a whole lot like something we had studied before. Which was the action for this auxiliary variable chi. Right, that one just looked like chi dot squared minus di chi squared minus m squared a squared minus a double dot over a chi. So this is just the action for a massless scalar field. Where I trade A with Z, right? So it's a massless scalar field living in a universe where the scale factor is Z instead of A. Okay, that's great. Because now I don't have to do anything. We already did it, right? So everything we had studied before for chi will now carry over directly to V. So that's kind of nice. We don't have to do much extra work. So in particular, we know how the mode functions for zeta or for v will behave, right? That's v double dot k plus k squared minus z double dot over z. Vk equals zero. That's the equation of motion for the mode functions. We quantize it just like we did before. So we'll Fourier expand and quantize just like we did for chi. And then we'll find that the mode functions obey this equation. And the quantity of interest, of course, is going to be delta v. And that, again, is going to be the same as before. This will just be k cubed vk squared over 2 pi squared, just as before. So we can look at this z double dot over z and ask how closely it's related to what we had before, which was the A double dot over A. So this thing you can show, again, after a little bit of pain and a little bit of algebra, goes like A double dot over A times 1 plus some constant that has to do with these slow roll parameters that we introduced. And so during slow roll inflation, we're basically in the regime where we have De Sitter space, and these things are small. So this looks like what we had before, 2 on eta squared for De Sitter, plus some correction. Which has to do with these slow roll parameters. And so, quote, horizon crossing in terms of this z variable, in other words, the condition that, you know, k squared as compared to z double dot over z is basically the same as the comparison we had been making before, which is k squared versus a double dot over a, up to these small factors. Okay, so it's a little bit different, just up to these small factors, it's the same. And so we also know here from what we did with chi is that, again, super horizon modes freeze in, and that just comes directly from this equation. Just forget about this thing, and this is exactly the same equation we studied for chi, right? So super horizon modes still freeze in, and we can do the same thing we did before, which was to match the sub horizon solution. That was just the one where vk goes like 1 over square root k, e to the ik eta, with the super horizon solution where vk goes to a constant. Well, v doesn't go to a constant. It goes to a constant times a, I believe. And then we can find delta v, and using v equals z m Planck times zeta, which equals 2 a squared epsilon 1 m Planck times zeta, we can calculate the fluctuation spectrum for zeta. And it's going to be given by that. Okay, so compare this to what we had for phi. So for phi, this was hk over 2 pi squared evaluated at k equals h, right? So one difference is that here there's no m Planck. The reason for that is that phi has mass dimension 1, and zeta is a dimensionless thing, right? Okay, it's a dimensionless thing because there's an m Planck that came from expanding is that action, this action, right? So there was an m Planck living in here. So when I expanded that, zeta gets hit with that, okay? The other difference is that the fluctuation in phi, the scalar field living in the background, only depended on h. But the fluctuation in zeta depends on both h, but also this slow roll parameter, epsilon 1. Okay? So it's a little bit different than just a free scalar up to that factor. So we can connect this a little bit more directly to specific models of inflation by writing this in terms of these slow roll parameters that had to do with the potential and not the ones that had to do with the behavior of the scale factor. So during slow roll, you can show that this is equal to epsilon 1, which we had defined over there. So this is equal to dh dt over h squared. Outside of slow roll, that won't hold, but it holds in slow roll. So now we can rewrite the spectrum for zeta in terms of properties of the potential. So in terms of V and its derivatives, then this is going to be V cubed over 12 pi squared times the derivative of V squared all over M Planck to the sixth power. And this is evaluated at the time a given mode crosses the horizon. So now we can directly connect this power spectrum for zeta to a specific model of inflation, right? And furthermore, if I want to get delta phi, then this is just going to be by that relation we had written up here, related by a factor of 3/2 squared to the power spectrum for zeta. So this is going to be, it's going to be 4/9. Delta zeta squared, right? So now we have the quantity that we ultimately want, right? So if you believe that this quantum to classical transition occurs, which I certainly believe it does, although I can't give you a really strong argument, then we have what we want, right? Which is the power spectrum for phi. And that's the thing that we can turn into the CLs that we observe. We know how to do that. Okay, so that's a really important result. Certainly deserves appreciating. This is a direct connection between some microscopic model of physics during inflation that makes quantum mechanical fluctuations grow up to be bigger than the observable universe, and then they come back in the horizon and turn into structure through phi. Yeah. Okay, where did the so that came from the relation between zeta and phi. So I just need to multiply by that factor to go between the two. Yes. Yeah, that's right. So another way of looking at it could be you're constraining some combination of h and the slow roll parameter. Yeah, that's exactly right. So if you had a different model, so for example, maybe I don't have a single field slow roll inflation, just for example. So if I don't have this canonical type model, then this correspondence won't hold, so I can't make that substitution. But this formula would still be valid in terms of h and epsilon. So if I have some other model, say with a funky kinetic term for the field or something else, then I could still apply that formula and get the right answer. But making this identification with the potential certainly is predicated on the assumption that I have a single field and it's slow roll, and this is the way that things are related. So there is an assumption built in there. Okay, so that's the power spectrum. And it depends on scale. So it's possible to calculate what the spectral index is, right? So what is NS? So NS minus 1 is given by 2 times another slow roll parameter. Which is m Planck squared times the second derivative of v with respect to phi over v. By the way, we've seen this before. This is really just the same thing as that term over there we had, which was the m squared over 3h squared. Okay. So if I had a massive scalar field, then that's all that this is. This is what happened to the when the scalar field got eaten by zeta, that contribution is still there. Yeah. But now, instead of having negative 2 epsilon 1 v, we get a negative 6. And that's the difference between a double dot and z double dot over z. Okay. So this particular combination comes from the particular form of that correction up there. So it varies with scale a little bit different than just a massless scalar and just iter. Yes? So I would do exactly what I did before. I would say if I have an exactly massless scalar, I don't have this correction. But then I want to compensate that for how much decay happens. And that's the compensating factor for how much decay happens. Another way of doing it would just be to figure out what exactly the function of z double dot over z is in terms of these epsilon 1 and epsilon 2, and then solve that equation. And you'll get mode functions that depend on k to a certain power. And the power will be this. So you can get this from the exact solution to the mode equations. I'd love to do it in light of the time. It's just not going to happen. So this is for scalars, right? And today in tutorial, you're going to learn about the tensor modes, so primordial gravitational waves. So for the tensors, what you'll show is that this looks like two massless scalars living in the background inflationary universe. So the tensors behave like two copies of chi or of phi, I guess I should say. And so we know the answer. That's just what we did yesterday, But you'll show it in more detail in the tutorial today why that's true and what the answer is. So for the tensors, we're going to get some spectrum, which if we put in the right factors of 2, et cetera, and we write things in terms of V instead of H. So here we've just used the fact that H is equal to 8 pi g over 3 times V, which is equal to M Planck squared over 3 times V. That's where the 3 came from. That the spectrum for tensors is just given by this. Okay, so that's the amplitude. And then who can tell me what the spectral index for tensors will be? So it's a massless copy, two massless copies of chi. So what would the, sorry? What's that? Yeah, exactly. So it's just negative 2 epsilon 1. So there's a particular quantity that we will be interested in. Which is the tensor to scalar ratio. That's basically just the amplitude of the spectrum in the tensors to the amplitude of the spectrum in the scalars. And this, what we call R. And that is, you can show, equal to 16 times epsilon v. So if we put this all back in terms of our epsilon v, then this is what you'll get. Okay, so it just depends on this slow roll parameter. Okay, so this is kind of nice because this delta squared zeta is something that we measure, right? That's like the total amplitude of fluctuations. And because this is something we measure, and delta t squared is just proportional to the absolute energy scale of inflation, the knowledge of R tells us about the energy scale that inflation happened at, right? So I can just use this to solve for V. I can use R equals this to solve for V. If I know delta zeta squared. And so the energy scale of inflation, V to the quarter power, goes something like, there's some constants that give you about 0.01 R to the quarter power times 10 to the 16 JeV. So a non-observation of R gives you a constraint on the energy scale of inflation. An observation of R, an observation of tensors, would actually tell you about the energy scale of inflation. So what do we know? From the best CMB experiment ever, Planck. Yep. Oh, sorry about that. I'm mixing notation. So what do we know about the best experiment ever, Planck? So you'll recall that the CLs you can relate to P phi. That's something you're doing in the homework right now. And so on the Sachs-Wolfe plateau, you can use the CL to tell you what the amplitude is, right? So you can use the CLs to tell you about the magnitude of, why don't we call it, we'll just call it what we had before, P zeta or delta zeta squared. So we can get the amplitude of delta zeta squared by looking at the amplitude of the CLs on this Sachs-Wolfe plateau roughly. Okay, and we can get the spectral index. From measuring the higher L's, so that's going to be the overall tilt. And the tensors well, it turns out they contribute also to this Sachs-Wolfe plateau. But they also source polarization of the CMB. Again, a fascinating, interesting, extremely important topic that I won't have time to cover. But just so you know, tensors polarize the CMB in a very specific way. They give rise to modes that have curl, which is why they're called B modes. Nothing else does that. So from these measurements, sort of now the state of the art, well, we know that NS is about 0.9616 plus or minus 0.0094. Okay. So to within more than 5 sigma, we know it's a red tilt. So that's what we know this is. From the non-observation of B modes and from the contribution that they would give to the temperature power spectrum, we know that R is less than 0.11. Okay. So tensors can't make any more than 1/10 of the power spectrum. And that's basically what we have to go on. We also know that delta zeta squared is about 10 to the minus 10. And that's what we know. So we can use these formulas we've derived now to go and test different models of inflation by comparing them against these measured values that we have here. Okay. So one thing you'll notice immediately is that this is a hard business because we don't really have very many numbers to go on. So we're basically working with these three observable quantities, and they're supposed to tell us about models of inflation, you know, basically V and its derivatives. And that's not really a whole lot of information, so there's going to be a lot of degeneracy. But nevertheless, models are very distinguishable. Models have been rolled out. Plausible, nice models have been rolled out using those numbers there. And man, time flies. I wanted to show you how to do that today, but we're going to have to do it tomorrow morning. So tomorrow is the last lecture. Sadly, I have so many more things I would like to tell you about, but we won't get there. So for tomorrow, I hope to go through exactly how you would test a model of inflation if you gave me a model of inflation. And then I will probably only get to talk about eternal inflation for half an hour and tell you what it is. And then you'll have to come talk to me sometime if you want to know more. So we'll stop there for today. Are there any questions before we break? Yeah, so we can get that from here. So if the energy scale is basically less than 10 to the 16 JeV, roughly. So if we put 0.11 in here, that's to the quarter power, so that's going to do like nothing. And then, so V to the quarter power is basically going to be less than about 10 to the 16 GeV. We don't have a detection, so we just have an upper bound, right? The best we'll ever do is probably about 0.01 for R, at least the best we'll ever do with Planck. So that's not really going to change very much. That constraint on the energy scale of inflation is not going to change by very much. And I would say even in the far distant future, unless there is a detection, this constraint is always going to be just about there. It's not going to change very much from 10 to the 16 JeV. Any other questions before we stop for the day?
Yeah?
Yes. Yeah. So then, yeah. You do a bit better on V, but okay. The thing you're interested in really is kind of the absolute energy scale, the scale that determines it, characterizes it, which is V to the quarter. Any other questions? All right, see you tomorrow.